Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we have our old Soapbox friend and my old friend, David Swanson, on to talk about the Chilcot Report, a report that delved into the crimes and lies and just terrible decision to invade and occupy the country of Iraq. And we talk about that among other things. David is a longtime anti-war activist. He works at davidswanson.com, World Beyond War. And he just is a very dedicated anti-war pro-peace activist. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with David Swanson. David Swanson, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Hi, Cindy. Great to hear from you.
Thank you. So, David, as soon as the Chilcot Report came out, I immediately thought about you. I thought about the work that we've done for accountability for war crimes and crimes against humanity, against the U.S. Government. And so I wanted to bring you on the show to talk about this. I think a significant aspect of this, of all of our, you know, our past activism. So talk a little, what is the Chilcot Report?
Well, it's a report put together by a big committee of people led by a guy named Chilcot over the past several years in the United Kingdom that held numerous hearings interviewing witnesses and went through numerous drafts and negotiated the wording and came up with millions of words. You know, the thing is longer than the works of Shakespeare or the Harry Potter books or the Bible,
wow.
And as much of a jumble as any of those things. It has an executive summary that I think is like 150 pages, and the closer you get to the beginning summary of the summary, the more it reads like it was written by the criminals themselves, you know, and talks about as if the weapons were there and all this sort of nonsense. But when you get into the heart of it, even of the summary, it makes crystal clear, and most of this was knowable if you wanted to know it for the past decade or more.
Right.
It makes crystal clear that Tony Blair agreed with George W. Bush to go to war and to lie about it many months before saying that war was the last resort. It also, the report says in so many words repeatedly, it was not the last resort, which of course you can say about every war that has ever happened. It makes clear that his own intelligence people, as they call themselves, advised him that Iraq was not a threat, that other nations were much more seriously a threat, that it had no nuclear weapons, that under the sanctions it could not ever have nuclear weapons, that it probably had no biological or chemical weapons, but if it did, the only way to get those to be used or handed off to terrorists would be to attack Iraq, and that attacking Iraq would be very likely to endanger, not protect, but endanger the United Kingdom and the United States, and to increase terrorism and to create the sort of chaos and disaster that could lead to something as it did, like ISIS. And of course, his top legal authority told him it would be illegal and then was persuaded to sort of kind of hedge and almost change his mind at the last minute as required. And you know, the report, you know, it doesn't draw the appropriate conclusions. It doesn't make any useful recommendations, you know, and nothing in that regard really has come out of it yet. But if you look at the evidence that is in the report, it is extremely damning. And so there's now an effort in the parliament to, you know, to censure Tony Blair, to hold him in contempt of parliament for this. And half of that is worded outrageously in terms of, you know, not enough planning was done for a proper occupation and so forth. But some of it is quite good, and it should be passed, and Jeremy Corbyn is supporting it, and it should be followed by impeachment and by criminal prosecution.
So who impaneled this committee?
The parliament and the government in the United Kingdom, I think some 7 years back, and this followed various other inquiries and reports, and it has itself dragged out much longer than anybody ever said it would, and been delayed and delayed again and delayed again, and has been, you know, very frowned upon by our friends in the Stop the War Coalition, who have held their own People's Chilcot Inquiry hearings and, you know, denounced it as likely to be a whitewash or partially being a whitewash, but who have, as I've just done, pointed to the damning evidence in it after it came out. And of course, if you compare what they've got to what we've got in the United States, at least it's something. At least it is, you know, a step in the direction of truth and accountability. And, you know, Tony Blair is in the news as a criminal and can't show his face in public without protest, whereas George W. Bush is dancing and joking at a funeral for police officers in Dallas and goes back to, you know, painting himself in the bathtub and golfing and whatever he does. You know, the contrast is stark between that sort of minimal, you know, gesture in the direction of respect for the rule of law in the United Kingdom, and just nothing in the United States.
What does impeachment of a former UK prime minister look like?
Well, you know, impeachment has been done even in the United States to officials who were no longer in office, which I think I first learned about when John Nichols did a book about impeachment at the time when you and I and others were trying to get Bush and Cheney and gang impeached. And it is entirely possible to hold an impeachment, you know, inquiry and vote, which is essentially an indictment to be followed by a trial in a legislature, whether, you know, the Senate in the case of the United States or the Parliament in the case of the United Kingdom, and then to come up with a guilty finding and then to enforce some sort of punishments, which can include and have included in past examples, denial of the opportunity to hold any future public office. And this is, even without impeachment, part of this this measure that's now facing a vote in the parliament on Blair, deny him the ability to ever again hold any public office. You can also deny benefits from past offices, you know, be they financial or the Secret Service or whatever. You know, so there are various penalties you can impose, but also importantly, you know, the public censure, the public condemnation, the public insistence that the crime be acknowledged and not be repeated, which can include also public questioning of the accused. And of course, in the United Kingdom, prime ministers are always facing serious and hostile questioning on the floor of the parliament, unlike anything, you know, that U.S. presidents ever face in Congress or even the media, which is, you know, again, another measure of accountability for top officials in that government compared with the U.S. government.
Right. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much a former president can cost the taxpayers in the United States. And that's in terms of monetary costs. You know, it's not in terms of the injustice of allowing, and, you know, I want to posit that probably most of our, the presidents here in the United States have committed high crimes and misdemeanors while in office. And so not just in terms of monetary costs, but in terms of, like you said, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, all of those people are profiting handsomely from, you know, their so-called time in public service, while many people, millions of people, counting here in the United States, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places, are suffering.
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, putting someone like George W. Bush or Dick Cheney in prison might be, you know, among the very few examples where that was actually a cost-saving measure. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, typically the United States spends more on putting somebody in prison than it would spend on sending them to Harvard. But in this case, you know, substituting prison for Secret Service details, it might actually be a cost saving. I don't know that I want them in prison. I don't know that I want anyone long term in U.S. prisons, certainly not as U.S. prisons exist today. What I really want is truth and reconciliation. I want confession and apology. And then I want reparations to the people of Iraq, to the people of Afghanistan, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, etc., for the deaths and destruction and damage done. And, you know, it's, and I, of course, want to include in the list of people who need to be held accountable the Democratic crew of the Obama regime of the past several years, yes, as well, yes, as the Republican predecessors. You know, I fail to grasp how people distinguish this one particular war and this one particular administration out of all of the, you know, many wars during the so-called global war on terrorism / overseas contingency operations. It is good that that all the former Republican presidents have said they won't go to the Republican convention. They may save a few bucks on guarding them in that disaster. But of course, there are, you know, all the past Democratic presidents alive will be at the Democratic one. The other thing I don't want is an inquiry in the United States along the lines of Chilcot, because the facts have been known from the start and were always public. Right, you know, I mean, the articles of impeachment that Congressman Kucinich introduced on George W. Bush years ago, people can go to warisacrime.org/Bush and read them and watch the videos of Kucinich introducing them. The facts are indisputable. The facts were always known. It's not legal or moral or practical to bomb and invade and occupy a country whether or not they have weapons, even if all the lies were totally true, you know, and of course they weren't, and they knew it at the time. And the Chilcot report tries to, you know, to fudge that in its language, but it, you know, it ends up admitting all the facts.
And what you just talked about brought up a couple of follow-up questions for me, but one of them is that you said that, you know, people are focusing on this one war on Iraq and not the all the ones that came before and all the ones that have come after. And like I say, as if George Bush and Dick Cheney invented wars based on lies for profit. But this was a big issue in the recent Democratic primaries when people who supported Bernie Sanders, they seemed like focused on he didn't vote for the resolution to invade Iraq, but you know, Hillary Clinton did, like that was the only vote that mattered in a long history of supporting other wars, other invasions, other war funding after they did after he didn't vote for Iraq, he voted for every single funding bill.
Yeah, this is a problem in our political system and with Bernie Sanders as a candidate, unlike Jill Stein, who is great on this topic, as on all others that I'm aware of. You know, Sanders, you know, has backed half the wars that have come in front of him in terms of initial votes to launch wars. You know, the wars in the Democratic Party wars, the war on Yugoslavia, the war on Afghanistan. Which was, right. You know, Barbara Lee was the sole holdout in both houses of Congress, and he has, you know, supported allowing numerous other unofficial wars. He has supported funding the wars with his votes once they've started. He swore up and down that he would continue to murder people with drones. You know, he refused. To say anything about cutting military spending,
right.
You know, and this is someone who, you know, not only can we speculate that he knows better, but he was absolutely wonderful on these topics like 50 years ago, and has got gradually worse bit by bit for the past five decades, you know, and to the point where he now really sees militarism as a jobs program and
right.
allows its corruption of himself in his state and his district, which was his state when he was in the House. And you know, when he was asked during this campaign, why are you going to raise taxes? How are you going to pay for all of these things? And he had these, you know, jumbled, mumbled, detailed responses about, well, your taxes will go up, but you won't have to pay for private health insurance, and so 86% of you will save money in this. You know, it's so complicated that, you know, they wouldn't – I mean, he was shut out by the media. You know, they never showed a speech until it was his speech endorsing Hillary. You know, and they weren't going to go for these complicated explanations. When Jill Stein is asked, you know, how are you going to pay for free college – she says, well, we could cut one airplane program, you know, and of course, it's the one that Bernie Sanders sold out on and backed because it would bring jobs to his state. You know, so there's a stark contrast between candidates there. And whether Bernie would have not gotten as far as he did had he spoken up for peace and diplomacy and the rule of law and sane budget priorities, I don't know. I mean, it's speculation. The media hardly could have been worse to him than it was already. So I think he would have benefited from having a clear, you know, soundbite response to all the accusations of you're going to raise taxes. No, I'm not. I'm going to cut 5% of military spending. That's all he had to say. And I think it would have benefited him, but he didn't have the guts, he didn't have the decency, he didn't have the ideology, the frame of mind. He's come over the decades to think in terms of accepting war and militarism, and you know, that's who he is now, as he's come to think in terms of loyalty to the Democratic Party. And so everybody, you know, wanting him to leave and run as an independent or run with Jill Stein in the Green Party, yeah, of course that's good advice, but he's not going to take it.
Well, he's realistically been a Democrat at least since he's been in Congress. He's been more of a Democrat than many Democrats that he, you know, has served with. But another thing you brought up was that you would like apologies. One of the things that happened after the Chilcot report was that Tony Blair had a non-apology, where
yeah.
at the end of it, he said, I still think it was the right thing to do. After, like you said, millions of pages, or words, not pages, millions of words that actually contested that it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, he could, but Tony Blair continues to lie to himself as well as to the public. And, you know, you'll recall at the time he said, we're not doing this to overthrow a government. That would be illegal. We're just doing an operation to rid Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to protect ourselves because they're going to nuke us in 45 minutes. And now he says, oh, well, we launched this war in order to save the Iraqi people from an evil dictator and get rid of him, which, of course, you know, the evil dictator had long had U.S. support. And according to the president of Spain, after conversation with the president of the United States, George W. Bush, had been willing to leave if he could keep $1 billion or various other negotiating points. And of course, it was illegal, just as Blair admitted at the time. But then in his scenario, in his fantasy, in his mind, and it filters its way into the Chilcot report as well. Once this noble deed of illegally overthrowing a government, and dropping tens of thousands of bombs on a capital city was done, well, then the occupation tried nobly to protect the Iraqi people and bring them democracy and stability, but they were too backward and stubborn and sectarian, and they started a civil war among themselves, and you just couldn't help them. They weren't mature enough, you know, which I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this show or not, but I have no respect for that position. The evidence is all to the contrary, that invasions and occupations of this sort inevitably lead to that sort of violence and backlash, much of which was against the occupiers, not just against each other, and that prediction was handed to Tony Blair and George W. Bush before they invaded. They knew this would come, and then they set about dividing the people of Iraq and attacking one sect rather than another and creating a segregated and violent and armed to the teeth nation that is suffering to this day and has suicide bomb attacks to this day, worse than any we're seeing in Europe, that get, you know, less than 1% of the news coverage of when there's one in France.
So, I understand some families in Great Britain and the UK who's had loved ones who were killed in Iraq they're planning a lawsuit against Tony Blair, or they have presented a lawsuit against Tony Blair.
I think there may be a new one. I'm not sure. In light of the Chilcot inquiry involving, among others, I think people that you and I have met and worked with back in the day, like right. Reg Keyes and what's the woman from Scotland we
Rose
met
Gentle.
With? Yes, and others, and of course they should. Of course, Reg also ran against Tony Blair for Parliament and did quite well. Of course they should be doing that, and of course it is the right thing to do. On the other hand, it is the only mention in the news coverage of the Chilcot report of any human suffering caused by a war that killed well over 1 million human beings in Iraq and created refugees out of some 5 million and destroyed the infrastructure and the soil and the air and the water of that country. I wish that the suffering of the Iraqis could get some mention too. You know, there's actually a U.S. soldier stationed in Kuwait now, I think, who took a case to court this month against President Obama for waging war against ISIS without proper authorization from Congress, that is in violation of the War Powers Resolution. And I read this 46-page response submitted to the court by the Department of Justice for President Obama, and among his defenses was, this guy has no standing to sue me over this war because he hasn't suffered anyway. Well, you know, there are thousands and thousands of people who, by that definition, have clear standing to sue President Obama over any number of wars and Bush and Blair before him.
What is the status of that lawsuit?
Well, additional arguments, and I wrote this up at davidswanson.org, my right. summary and a link to the full 46-page thing, but among the additional arguments are the courts have no capacity, no ability, are too stupid and ignorant, and no constitutional right to interfere with political matters that should be left to the president and the Congress, which is the established record of the courts and almost inevitably what the D.C. Circuit Court will rule against itself on this. It will declare itself to not have any constitutional right to interfere with the president and the Congress. And of course, and there are numerous other arguments, including that by funding the war, or even by refusing to officially cut off funding for the war, the Congress has, in fact, authorized it and made it congressionally official, which is a much more reasonable argument, in fact, than some of the others in right. there, like right. the president has the constitutional right to do whatever the hell he wants, never mind what the Constitution itself actually says. But the weird thing about the ISIS war in Iraq and Syria and wherever else they want to take it is that Congress did pass funding, but it also passed language saying nothing, not a dollar can be spent if it's in violation of the War Powers Resolution, which of course it is, But the problem with Congress's mixed messages is that they are so corrupt and inept and cowardly that they want to allow every war and fund every war, but not officially put their name on it. Which is what leads to this confusion. But I think inevitably the court will rule that it has no say in the matter, and it will leave it up to the Congress.
Oh, did Obama put forward the look forward defense? We're not looking in the past. We have to look forward.
He uses that all the time to disastrous effect. He even used it in Hiroshima rather disgustingly, but I don't recall it in that particular document, although numerous other good old standbys came back. Even the Khorasan group, which was this almost fictional group of terrorists a couple years ago that they fear-mongered around in Syria and Iraq, came lives on forever in these legal defenses. The other thing I wanted to mention, if there's time, about the Chilcot report and what could be done after it, is that a lot of good, liberal lawyers are saying, well, the United States is not part of the International Criminal Court, so it can't be touched. And the International Criminal Court won't take up the crime of launching war, at least for the next couple years, if then, but it can go after particular atrocities during the war. And in fact, it is supposedly investigating particular British atrocities during the war. But if you look at Nuremberg and Tokyo, there was no International Criminal Court, and it wasn't needed. If you look at the special tribunals on Rwanda and Yugoslavia and other places, there was no International Criminal Court used. It was a special tribunal created by the UN that, in the case of the Nazis and the Japanese, prosecuted war. In the case of Rwanda and Yugoslavia, prosecuted genocide, which is sort of the name for war done by somebody other than us, than the United States and the West, which doesn't do genocide, it does wars. But you could very easily set up such a tribunal on Iraq and prosecute all the criminals involved, and you could call it war or call it genocide, take your pick, it's both. And in the case of Rwanda, as in the case of the Nazis, you had prosecutions that included prominently the media outlets, because war propaganda is illegal under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, just as war is under the UN Charter and the Quilembrion Pact. And so I'm all for getting these Fox News executives on sexual harassment if they're guilty of it, but there are other things you could get them on too.
Every major media outlet in this country lied about Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right.
They all do, even the so-called liberal ones, the MSNBC paid, or the Pentagon paid shills to go on MSNBC, among others, but that's considered a so-called liberal station to shill for invasion.
A network that fired Phil Donahue and his producer and my friend Jeff Cohen, who had the most watched show on that network,
right.
and did so because they were afraid, and rightly so, that it wouldn't cheer for the war enough. So they preemptively, you know, got rid of that show and had on all the hired Pentagon spokespeople, just like CNN and Fox, and of course, without the New York Times and the Washington Post, you never could have had these stories that they all went on the networks to quote after planting. So yeah, it would be widespread. You would have to pick the top, most responsible officials from numerous media outlets to hold them accountable. If you had, whether it was a criminal prosecution or a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you know, it wouldn't be, you know, a single isolated bad apple. But I think all the more reason that it needs to be done.
I talked to Anderson Cooper once, and I said, why didn't you all, like, expose the lies and prevent an invasion? He said, well, Cindy, we could only ask the question so many times. Like, asking the politician a question is like hard-hitting investigative journalism.
God, this is how they think, right? Because
right.
They want access. They want to please people in power rather than informing the public. I mean, you remember when the Downing Street memo came out and then the White House memo and then all these, you know, documents would come out, and each time we would say, look at this evidence. And these things get, you know, like footnotes in the depths of the Chilcot report. But when the Downing Street memo came out and we went to the U.S. media and said, report this. This is, you know, the most official authoritative evidence we've seen so far, that they lied us into a war, you know, knowingly lied us, as they say, into a war. And the media outlets, the Washington Post, the USA Today, et cetera, started saying, oh, well, we knew this. This is old news.
Right.
We don't have to report this. And we said, well, where did you report it ever? You know, well, we knew it. We didn't report it. Well, you know, what good does that do their readers? What good does it do their listeners and viewers for them to have known it was a pack of lies but not told anybody? And then when the evidence comes out and it's a story around the globe, to say, oh, well, that's old, so we won't tell anybody yet. And the problem is that, believe it or not, millions of Americans don't know to this day. And you have things like, you know, the very latest incident of dozens, this guy driving a truck into people in the south of France, and everybody immediately screams Muslim terrorism, whether it is or not,
right.
And presidential candidates, in this case, most vociferously Trump, start shouting for, you know, a bigger war. As both he and Hillary did after Orlando, and yet you look and in France they start screaming for a bigger war, and yet you look at Spain when there was a terrorist attack in Spain, they immediately elected a leftist government, pulled Spain out of the war on Iraq,
right.
The terrorist attacks in Spain stopped, so it actually worked. So God forbid anyone should ever, you know, consider such a thing. And if the people in the United States knew the facts, you know, they would have different positions. It's not, you know, it's not just ideology or temperament or party. You know, it's knowledge of information.
Yeah, it is a dearth of information. Well, David Swanson, thanks for being on the Soapbox this week. You've said your website several times, and I'll link the articles and things that you mentioned, but give us your website one more time.
DavidSwanson.org and warisacrime.org and worldbeyondwar.org.
Thank you so much, David. And let's, you know, the problems are huge. It's, they almost seem insurmountable, but there's a proverb that says, how do you eat an elephant? And it's one bite at a time. And so thanks for trying to eat that elephant, even though you're a vegetarian.
With a side of donkey. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's the soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired to further action. I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank David Swanson for helping us eat that elephant. He's a very valuable member of our anti-war pro-peace community. I'd like to thank you for listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I am Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.